A 7.8 magnitude earthquake hits Turkey and Syria, killing over 500 people and injuring hundreds more. Israeli forces kill several Palestinians during a raid at a refugee camp near the occupied West Bank city of Jericho. Also ahead, Peru has expanded nationwide state of emergency to deal with the two-month-old violent protests against President Dina Boluarte. Welcome to World News from the reigning capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, a major earthquake has rocked southeastern Turkey, wreaking havoc across the country and causing large-scale damage in neighboring Syria. Officials in Turkey have so far confirmed 284 deaths and hundreds of injuries. South, across the border in Syria, the 7.8 magnitude quake also killed over 240 people and injured hundreds of others. The Turkish Disaster Agency has called for international support as search and rescue operations are underway to save those stuck under the rubble of fallen buildings. The death toll is likely to rise substantially in the coming hours as the earthquake hit when many people were asleep. The United States Geological Survey says the epicenter was the Turkish city of Gaziantep, but tremors were felt as far away as Egypt, Romania, and Georgia. Let's cross over to Rashan Saglam, our correspondent in the Turkish city of Istanbul. So, Rashan, since we last spoke, the fear was that the death toll would rise, and unfortunately, that has risen over the past hour.
Yes, in our last broadcast, I said that it is expected to rise, and it rose to 284 deaths. We have 2,323 injured, and 1,700 buildings have collapsed. Now, also the Interior Ministry announced that the aftermath earthquakes that came after the initial earthquake that took place in Kahramanmaraş, Pazarcık, were 78 small earthquakes aftermath that happened starting from at 4:26 minutes, and the strongest was at 4:26, which was 6.6. The initial earthquake was 7.8 magnitude, and it was 10 kilometers deep. Now, the Turkish Interior Ministry is calling anyone who can help to head over to the headquarters of the Kızılay, the Turkish Red Crescent, to try and help, because there's deficiency in the people, there's deficiency in the materials. Now, also, as you mentioned, and I'm happy to hear mention, that the disaster agency in Turkey have called this as a level 4 alarm, which means that they are calling for international help. Now, the international help came quickly from Azerbaijan, Sweden, Russia, Japan, and the United States so far. Those are the countries that have already sent or are sending on the way the help to Turkey to help rescue people who are under the rebels. Now, the losses are huge. 10 cities, as I mentioned in my previous broadcast, were affected by this earthquake. Gaziantep, Kahramanmaraş, Hatay, Osmaniye, Adana, Adıyaman, Malatya, Şanlıurfa, Diyarbakır, and Kilis. But mainly the most damaged ones and the ones that have higher death tolls are Malatya, Kahramanmaraş, Gaziantep, and Hatay. This has to do with how close they were to the center of the earthquake, which took place in Pazarcık, as I mentioned, Kahramanmaraş. Also, the second one took place in Nurdağ, near Gaziantep. And as for Hatay and Malatya, it is due to the weak buildings in those areas and the material used in those buildings. As I mentioned, that the areas that we are mentioning in southeast Turkey are mainly areas for the less fortunate people who live there. So the buildings there are not really as strong. And the areas that were affected, actually, only three of those cities are prone to earthquakes, but the rest remaining seven cities, they don't usually witness earthquakes, so people are not prepared for something like this to happen. This is why the buildings are not as strong, the materials used in building those buildings are not as good as in areas like Istanbul, for example, and Diyarbakır, which are on the line of earthquakes, so they are used and they know what materials should be used in buildings. Now, we are still waiting for more information. The Interior Ministry, as I mentioned, they are calling for people for help. Also, the Red Crescent, the Kızılay, they are calling for people to give blood because we already have had deficiency throughout the past year in the blood supply in the Red Crescent, and they have been calling people to donate more, and we have been witnessing in the streets the campaigns for donating blood, and now, since this has happened, they are calling for people, whoever can donate the blood and is actually a Turkish national, to go and donate the blood.
Okay, Rashan, thank you very much indeed for that. Rashan Saklam there, our correspondent, joining us from the Turkish city of Istanbul. Just taking a look at the latest international reactions to this earthquake, and there have been many, but one that stands out is from the over the past half an hour, a statement was issued by the White House, where saying that U.S. President Joe Biden has instructed the federal government to prepare U.S. assistance to Turkey. He said the U.S. is profoundly concerned by the reports of today's destructive earthquake, and we stand ready to provide any and all needed assistance to Turkey. No mention, no reference by the U.S. about working or giving any aid to Syria, which the fatalities there are higher and the level of destruction are reportedly also higher, despite the dire humanitarian situation in Syria. At times of you kind of expect some kind of gestures here or there, but nothing from the United States indicating that it is willing to coordinate with the officials in Syria to provide them with any assistance. Moving on, the Syrian foreign minister says the U.S. and some of its European allies are hatching the same plot against his country they did 20 years ago for Iraq. In a Twitter post, Faisal al-Muqdad referred to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 on the pretext that it possessed weapons of mass destruction. He said that then U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell staged a scene of manipulation and lies at the U.N. Security Council to justify the invasion. Al-Muqdad said Powell used America's own satellite images and documents on Iraq's WMD, which later turned out to be non-existent. He added everything Powell put forward were mere unsubstantiated lies, which he himself acknowledged later. The top Syrian diplomat warned the U.S. and its allies, namely France, Germany and the U.K., against using similar pretexts to interfere in other countries' affairs. Elsewhere, the Israeli military says it has killed several members of Hamas resistance movement in a raid on the city of Jericho in the occupied West Bank. That's according to the Israeli regime's military. Palestinian media put the number of Palestinians killed by the regime at 7. They were targeted as the Israeli military launched the raid on the Aqabat Jabr refugee camp for the 9th consecutive day. The military says they are seeking a man who was allegedly involved in a shooting at an Israeli restaurant. Hamas has condemned the attacks and urged the camp residents to keep resisting the regime forces. The Israeli military has been carrying out almost daily incursions and raids in the occupied West Bank for the past year. At the last, at least 43 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone this year so far. Earlier, our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us to give the latest details on the Israeli raid in Ariha.
The Israelis claim that a number of Palestinian militants were hiding inside a house outside the Jabir refugee camp, and that clashes erupted between the Palestinians who were inside this house and the Israeli soldiers. They claim that at least three Palestinians were killed. Other Israeli media outlets have spoken about five. Others also reported that seven Palestinians were killed. Up till the moment, the Palestinian Health Ministry cannot confirm the number or confirm that there are people who were killed, because when the Israeli forces pull out from that area, no bodies were found. Palestinian Health Ministry said that three Palestinians were wounded and transferred to a hospital in Ariha. The Israelis are speaking about number of Palestinians were killed. This means if there are Palestinians were killed by the Israeli soldiers, then this means that the Israelis have took with them the bodies of the Palestinian martyrs. The Israelis said anyways that one of the Palestinian leaders of Hamas movement, Sheikh Shakir, had been detained from Aqbat Jabir, and they think that he was responsible for recruiting, let's say, the fighters who shoot at the Israeli restaurant in Ariha.
Now, moving on, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has pardoned and commuted the sentences of a large number of people arrested during the recent riots in the country. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei issued the decree in response to a request by the Iranian judiciary on the occasion of the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In its request, the judiciary head said many of those who committed crimes during the foreign-backed riots are now repentant and ask for forgiveness. Cases against those charged with crimes or convicted of them will now be dropped. The judiciary chief, however, said the clemency will not apply to those who committed espionage, murder, bodily harm, and vandalism. Those facing lawsuits by private litigations are not eligible for the amnesty as well. Ayatollah Khamenei has also granted amnesty to a number of people convicted of other minor crimes. The ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe wrapped up its work in Tehran. The meeting has provided a platform for developing economic cooperation and improving the level of trade and exchanges between the two countries, which have been under sanctions for years. Saman Kajuri reports.
The closing session of the ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.
Agriculture, exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Solat Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Makamuri Shava, said mutual ties with Iran is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Turning now to Peru, where the government of President Dina Boluarte has extended a state of emergency in seven southern regions in a bid to contain weeks of unrest. The state of emergency will remain in place for two more months. The government has also imposed a 10-day curfew in the Puno region, which has been the epicenter of the anti-government rallies. Around 50 people have been killed since the protests began following the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo in December. Protesters are demanding the resignation of Boluarte, early elections, as well as the release of Castillo. Boluarte has declined to step down, but she is pushing for snap elections. However, Congress has rejected several bills proposed by the president to advance the elections to this year. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. The victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran is the greatest and most influential phenomenon in the contemporary history. The victory of the Islamic Revolution, on the one hand, disrupted the political equations of the global arrogance, and on the other hand, toppled the Pahlavi regime, which was installed by the British and supported by the US. Of course, the place I'm going to visit today has something to do with what I just said. This place, which used to be a dreadful prison before the Islamic Revolution, is called Tehran's Ebrat Museum. This museum used to be a secret detention center in Tehran under the toppled Pahlavi regime, where the Shah's secret service known as the Savak widely practiced torture against the opponents of the Shah. This prison museum recalls a slice of the tragic and painful history of its prisoners for visitors by featuring the sculptures of torturers, prisoners, and different methods and devices that were used for torture. What I'm going to realize today by visiting this museum is getting to know more about the martyrs and revolutionaries whose efforts and struggle led to the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Every year, Iranians mark the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution from February 1st to 11th, known as the 10-day dawn ceremonies. The Iranian nation toppled the British-installed and US-backed Pahlavi regime 44 years ago on February 11th, 1979, ending 2,500 years of monarchic rule in the country. The festivities known as the 10-day dawn start with ceremonies that mark the return to Iran of Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, after 15 years in exile. Millions of Iranians welcomed Imam Khomeini in Tehran on February 1, 1979. Imam Khomeini's arrival intensified month of popular protest against the Pahlavi regime. 10 days later, the rallies culminated in the downfall of the Pahlavi regime, bringing the curtain down on more than 2 millennia of monarchy in Iran. The Islamic Revolution established a new political system, a republic based on Islamic values and democracy. I'm now inside the museum. Undoubtedly, the walls and the gates of this dreadful place have witnessed many horrible events here. It is said that the detention center was constructed by German engineers under the order of Reza Khan, the first Shah of the Pahlavi regime, in 1932. The place was used as the first modern political prison at that time. After the fall of Reza Khan, his son, Mohammad Reza, continued his father's policies aimed at suppressing his opponents. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, this place was turned into a museum to show the cruelty of the Pahlavi regime and the way prisoners were kept and tortured. At the entrance, there is a circular building on three floors with so many cells and winding corridors, all of which lead to the main area. Oh, you would get shocked with its mysterious architecture, which made any effort of escape end in failure. The architecture is in a way that it does not even echo the screaming sounds. That's the reason why nobody ever knew about this prison at the heart of the city for years. Significant features of this prison include the complex design, the symmetry of the rooms, and the echoes of sound in them, and the obnoxious architecture of the prison, designed to increase the fear and torture of prisoners. Here, I should go up the stairs. I am now in the corridor. Here, on this wall, you can see the names of those who were kidnapped and tortured by the Savak. 4,004 people were kidnapped and tortured here. Oh, it's horrible. Really horrible. On the first floor, there was a room for interrogating the prisoners. The prisoners were then forced to put their clothes in these metal lockers. Their photos were taken then and finally sent to cells. this jail used to have various sections, such as solitary confinement cells, torture places. It used to have 86 solitary confinement cells. Oh, I even heard that in critical conditions in 1979, the solitary confinement cells used to house 5 prisoners in a cell. Oh, it's even hard to imagine. Have come to see the torture places. Oh my God. I beg you to turn off the radio if you have children under 15 around. This is the rule of the museum, because what I'm going to describe is really horrible. I wait for a moment for you to keep the radio out of the reach of children, and then I continue my description. Before entering the torture places, I should say that the walls of this place is not normal at all. Oh, they are frightening. The walls speak. Although we are now at a museum, you can still hear the screams of those who were brutally tortured here by the Shah's agents. The museum showcases torture techniques used during the era of Pahlavi regime, as well as wax figures of the torturers and prisoners. Here is one of the torture rooms. You can see prisoners hanging with their hands tied with metal handcuffs or receiving lashes. Different torture techniques were used. More than 79 techniques, it said. Including torturing the prisoners with power cables, electric shocks. Oh my God. Ha ha ha. And there was something called the hot cage. God damn! This cage is 80 centimeters long and just 50 centimeters wide. It's made of metal pipes used for humiliating the prisoners, including students, the pupils, the ulema, the teachers. The cage was then got very hot by putting a heater under it, which led to burning the prisoners. I feel nauseous. Though, knowing the truth is necessary. And in this prison, the agents of the Savak used the following torture techniques. Pinching the body flesh with pliers. Oh my God, I can't believe it. Extinguishing the cigarettes on the prisoner's body. Oh, forcing the prisoners to imitate animal sounds. Depriving the prisoner to use restroom. Sleep deprivation. Pulling one's fingernails. Well, I cannot continue. I feel a pain in my heart. I couldn't breathe there. There were many worse torture techniques which I couldn't describe. I think that's enough. This prison was also used as a detention center for prominent figures such as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, God bless him. Well, I described this place as far as I could. To know more about the details of this museum, you can take a tour to this place. But remember something. When you visit the museum, just listen. The history speaks. Just listen. Listen deeply. Listen to those who made history and those who were thrown to the dustbin of history. I walk a little here in the fresh air. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has made an announcement that is void of the truth. It's issued a report that accuses Iran of making an undeclared change at the Fordo nuclear power plant. Iran made an objection and clarified the issue with the IAEA, which the agency admitted it had made a mistake. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the IAEA has once again not only politicized Iran's civilian nuclear file, but has now resorted to making false allegations against the Islamic Republic's civilian nuclear program. Let me introduce Seyed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Seyed Mohsen Abbas, welcome. So we're taking a look at this accusation in which, based on the IAEA, Iran had made an undeclared change to the interconnection, as it called, between the two clusters of advanced machines enriching uranium up to 60% purity at its Fordo plant. Iran has had a reaction to that, in which it said that the IAEA inspector's interpretation was incorrect, and then immediately obviously informed the IAEA on this. Why is the IAEA portraying this? First of all, why would the IAEA make a mistake? These are supposed to be professionals in this most sensitive of all fields.
Well, it's right to have a little laugh at these institutions, because they really have become a total joke and completely unprofessional. I mean, look, first of all, let's get the first fact on the table. In November 22, Iran actually sent a letter to the IAEA about the decision to do this 60% enrichment. Now, the JCPOA and all the other agreements are really pretty much null and void at the moment. There's no real reason that Iran should even be abiding by anything within that agreement. But even whether it's the non-proliferation treaty or the nuclear non-proliferation treaty that they're whinging about, the truth is Iran has no obligation to do anything on any of these issues. It's their magnanimity that they actually allow the IAEA to come in and essentially spy for their paymasters. Because look, the reality is that these institutions, and let's come directly to the IAEA itself in answer to part of your question, Rafael Grossi and the like, their pay salaries ultimately come from the kind of sources which are all aligned to the Zionist interests. Inside their establishments, they have the United States of America's various officers all installed in there, probably Zionist ones as well, Israeli ones covertly. So they are completely compromised. These institutions essentially are an instrument of what one analyst has described as pre-aggression. What their purpose is to basically create scenarios which indict Iran, and then basically come up with false charges based on the scenarios they create. And then when they can't prove those scenarios, already they've put it out to the media. So there's an environment of Iranophobia which they've developed, and they want to use those false charges then to create aggression, to create conflict, to create war and a mood music within their own Western environments to justify potential unilateral action by the U.S. and Israel against Iran.
Isn't that just another form of lying? I mean, really, if you want to take a look at it in a simpler term. Anyways, what's more interesting here, and I'd like to get your train of thought, is the way that this was reported in the news, where it says the IAEA report seen by Reuters, IAEA Chief Grossi is concerned that Iran has implemented a substantial change. Then, and it came in drips. IAEA report seen by Reuters, IAEA informed Iran that its failure to declare the change was inconsistent with Iran's obligations under Article 45. And then the way the wires work, they come in with these drips. Seyed Mohsen Abbas, maybe you're familiar, and then they issue a final report of which they say the UN nuclear watchdog chided Iran in a confidential report seen by Reuters for making an undeclared change to the interconnection between the two cascades, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, maybe you can tell us, why is it that the IAEA reports that are confidential are being overlooked by a media agency by the name of Reuters, and then for it to be broadcast, of which Iran has said, what's going on here? Why are we getting leaks like that?
Well, very simply, put simply, the Reuters themselves, if you look at the history of Reuters, you'll see that they are a complete Zionist operation themselves. They have corporate Zionist masters and owners. They are run for the purposes of creating psychological operations, media propaganda, fake news, all geared towards supporting the Zionist Western Empire and their imperialist interests. The IAEA, therefore, are working essentially in tandem with another arm of that Zionist network. This is an intricate network which clearly has infiltrated virtually every major world institution, whether it's the WHO, whether it's the World Health Organization or the United Nations or the International Atomic Agency here or whoever else overlooks the interests economically of the world. What you see is essentially a very carefully laid out set of, institutions which work for the same interests. And this is the thing that one has to understand. And that interest, the money mafia interest, the Zionist-led money mafia interest, its number one enemies is, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, because everything that Iran stands for, whether it's sovereignty, independence, its vilayat-e-faqih political system, its desire to be, on its own feet, and its progress, its advancement, its rapid advancement in the science and technological fields and all others, all of this poses a challenge to the illusions and the veneer of actual systemic, goodness that they like to usually place in the camp of the Zionist imperialist kind of institutions. The fact is that those are all being exposed by Iran, and the IAEA, the JCPOA, the nuclear issue is a major revealer of these realities. So what you've got is a synchronization. These things are discussed in the corridors of power, where the Israeli lobbies will be present, and they'll pressure and push a particular line. The state operators, the politicos, the media, and of course these other institutions, then will be all clicked, simultaneously to do their particular job as and when required. And that's what you're seeing. It's all very synchronized.
Well, you talked about the Zionist regime. Of course, I'd like to find out from you what are we looking at when it comes to their participation, which they are very active, either in front of the camera through its very animated Prime Minister Netanyahu or behind the scenes. Of course, the most recent being the visit by Israel Prime Minister to France. Interesting that France would issue anything against Iran on a civilian nuclear program in the presence of Israel when it helped Israel to develop his nuclear warhead program.
Well, this idea of helping is a very important one, because it goes well beyond helping. They establish and root all of the kind of instability in the west of Asia, particularly through Israel. Israel is their primary frontline mechanism for creating division, creating disunity amongst the Arabs, for also threatening them with military punishment and other kinds of punishment. Israel is essentially the landing base for the Anglo-Zionist empire in West Asia, and it's the chief nest of conflict creation. And in this instance, what you're seeing is Israel, being exposed again, actually, because, it's an open secret that the Israelis have well over 400 or so Iranian nuclear arms, fully tooled up. I mean, and yet what we've got is an IAEA and America and the Atlantic powers focusing on an Iran that doesn't have nuclear capability as yet, and has said that it doesn't want it either, for that matter, and has gone into negotiations to try and create a situation where everybody can be satisfied, yet that's all being rejected. And yet there is Israel, sitting right in that same region, the most nasty, the most brutal, the most torturing, undemocratic nation in that region. And that's saying something, given you've got Saudi Arabia and other despots in that region as well. There you have this particular entity, which is allowed to continue building this nuclear stockpile, and it is not subject to the non-proliferation treaty, the nuclear non-proliferation treaty at all. The IAEA makes no inspections of Israel and its kind of nuclear facilities. It doesn't even have the right to do those. And the US and the British and the French and the Germans make absolutely no noise whatsoever. But here are those same powers in Iran's situation. They've been squealing, basically saying that Iran is inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Inconsistent? What about Israel? I mean, and what about, for instance, Saudi Arabia, which the Americans have literally tendered American nuclear production companies, corporates, to come in and tender for contracts to help Saudi Arabia to become nuclear developed. I mean, the hypocrisy is profound. And of course, it's all based on the fact that Israel sees Iran as its primary enemy in West Asia and its primary, if you like, opposition to Israel's own Odin Yinon plan, which is designed to basically dominate the whole of the west of Asia from the river to the sea, as they say, from the Euphrates to the Israeli, to the Mediterranean.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, it does sound like a broken record, but it really needs to always be brought into the conversation. So let's bring in John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst from Belgrade. John Bosnich, welcome. You know, the Israeli factor in Iran's civilian nuclear file has always been a thorn in the side of whatever blank you want to fill in. It's quite incredible because Israel is not a member of the NPT, but at the same time is receiving a cordial welcome when it comes to the IAEA. Where Iran is a member, and yet, as our guest there just indicated, the last statement coming from U.S. and the E3 is the fact that Iran is inconsistent, along with the language that IAEA has used. Why is it that a non-NPT member can have such influence on an NPT member and be received warmly by its aides or its allies?
Well, first of all, we have to categorize which non-member that is, and that's Israel. Israel holds itself out as an exceptional state, just as America does, the exceptional superpower. And therefore, both countries, which are allies to the deepest possible level, Israeli investments elect the president of the United States in most of the elections. So what we have here is a situation where two countries, which are actually self-declared outlaw states, which do not recognize these international tribunals, which do not recognize international bodies, have by themselves created an echo chamber in which one confirms the other and the rest of the world listens because they dominate the international media. So we're being fed an illusion here by parties which themselves have not only rejected these treaties and these rules, but which have flagrantly violated them. Israel is a nuclear superpower, not just a nuclear power. In its regional area, Israel is a nuclear superpower, and it is now threatening Iran and using its leverage in the United States to pressure Iran and to actually threaten war on Iran for what Iran has opened to public inspection via the organizations of the IAEA, which is, among other international organizations, infiltrated from the top to the bottom by representatives of, guess who? Israel and the United States. It's a closed chamber in which they want to dominate all power.
Some ask, why does Iran need a civilian nuclear program? John Bosnich, Based on what statements were given by the head of the Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, one of them is that he said just recently that Iran intends to generate 20% of its electricity via nuclear energy. That on the one hand. And just today in our news, we had how he officially announced the production line of sanitary, superabsorbent, blood-clotting power and the Essence microwave extractor. These are all medicinal uses of energy, nuclear energy, and basically the civilian aspect that Iran is using to the fullest. This is something that is somewhat overlooked, especially for people who ask why Iran needs a nuclear energy program with civilian purposes. Why then would there be such pushback from the U.S. and from, of course, Israel and other, again, allies?
First of all, we have to put this all in context. The entire world is talking about global warming. Iran is a major petroleum product producer, and Iran is looking at a short-term elimination of its major revenue, which is from petroleum products. My own home country, Canada, has had a nuclear program since the 1960s. We have nuclear plants across the country. There is a nuclear power plant less than 1 hour's drive from my hometown. Nobody asked Canada what we were going to do with our nuclear power plants. Nobody asked us what was the rationale for us as one of the world's leading petroleum product producers out of our Western oil fields, why we needed nuclear power. And so if we put this thing in context, why is it that Iran is asked to justify every action that it takes, which is simply a follow-on and identical to actions which have been taken by dozens of countries across the Western world? The difference, Iran is not an American colony, and we, the others, are. That's the difference. And if you were an occupied American colony, they would be pushing your nuclear power program. They would actually be suggesting to you that you get involved in their nuclear weapons research program as well. That's the way this world is run. It is not fair, and you are on the receiving end of the American empire and its Israel partners.
Mm-hmm. Simonson Abbas, recently there was an occurrence that basically needs your breakdown as to the way it happened and as to the results that it got. And it was how the European Union was trying to push the IRGC, Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, to be listed as a terrorist organization. And they rounded up their MPs. They had a meeting about that. Of course, prior to that, lots of media hype about that. But it came down to the fact that Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said, listen, if you're going to go ahead with this, then there might be some question marks and maybe a move by Iran in order to move away from being a member of the NPT. And then we noticed somebody, not